This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Black regiments in the Civil War are still a relatively obscure aspect of American history. Though many didn't battle, these units were vital in keeping the Union intact. A group of historians based in Goldsboro have rediscovered one of those regiments, the 135th U.S. Colored Troops. Chris Thomas has this.
So he says, I am 67 years of age, and I live 2.5 miles from Eureka, North Carolina. I knew Jack.
Philip Fort was a North Carolina native, soldier, and former slave, revealed through Amy Brower, a Goldsboro insurance broker and genealogist. Fort was a member of the 135th U.S. Colored Troops. This testimony was taken as part of a pension request filed about 30 years after the war's end.
I enlisted in the infantry in Goldsboro, March 27, 1865. Now,
Amy said little was known about the regiment when she and her husband, Jay Bauer, started investigating the unit's history 2 years ago.
We had heard that there was no pictures whatsoever of this troop, and with our background in genealogy, we thought, well, this would be something good to take on that we could research and maybe we could dig up.
The 135th story begins with one of the nation's most renowned and controversial Union generals, William T. Sherman. His troops were known for their speed, effectiveness, and ruthlessness. His strategy of total warfare included seizing and destroying infrastructure crucial to the Confederacy's war effort. But Sherman's troops needed roads on which to travel, and as the war neared its end, Sherman led his soldiers northward from Savannah to the Carolinas. That campaign led the soldiers to a small railroad town about 90 miles west of the Pamlico Sound, Goldsboro.
They had to build the bridge over the Neuse River, which was a big concern, and the closer they got to the Neuse River, the less timber they had. So in one of the memoirs, he said, don't worry about the timber, we'll take it off the houses if we need it.
That bridge was built, in large part, by the 135th USCT, 222 of whom were from North Carolina. They officially mustered in Cary in 1865. Like most segregated units, they saw little combat, and mostly defended forts and outposts before they were disbanded. Deborah Jones is a descendant of one of those soldiers, Silas Caudale. She's a retired U.S. Air Force nurse and still lives near Seymour Johnston Air Force Base in Goldsboro. She was already working on her own genealogical project and came across his name in a wedding certificate.
I went to the library here in Goldsboro, Wayne County Public Library, for a genealogy program. And Marty Tesler, the librarian there, had a poster about these colored troops. And one of the names that was prominently stood out was Silas Caudale. And I was like, oh my gosh, the 135th in Goldsboro? I never heard of this. Where did this come from?
Like the Bowers, Jones learned about Caudale through his pension records. Soldiers, or their relatives, had to give detailed descriptions of their past lives, their relationships, and what they did during the war. Jones, who was in the Air Force for 30 years, was stunned by what they had to do to collect their pensions.
I thought it was quite a bit for them to have to prove that they served when the government already had a roster with their names on it. But yet they had to constantly prove by more than one or two people. They had to have many people prove that this was a person, and yes, they served, and yes, I knew he served.
Though many of them died a century ago, individuals named in the 135th Genealogy Project, headed by the Bowers, were rediscovered. Jones said she liked the man she learned about, her relative and a fellow member of the U.S. military. She said the veteran and father of 20 was a hard worker.
It wasn't that it was that you had to join the troops, because there were plenty of people that didn't serve, but he was willing to go and serve, you know, and this was an opportunity to help take care of his family too.
Black regiments weren't part of the U.S. Army until 1863, but by war's end, there were scores of them in North Carolina. That included the 1st NC Colored Regiment out of New Bern. They became the 35th USCT.
The raising of black troops in the area was a very dramatic story.
Dr. Gerald Prokopovich is a Civil War historian and professor at East Carolina University. The New Bern Regiment was organized, in part, by slave-turned-North Carolina State Senator Abraham Galloway.
In eastern North Carolina, the impetus came from within the black community. Abraham Galloway, most famously, organized, brought in refugees from the slave community who had escaped, who were willing to serve, and he and others negotiated with the Union leadership as to what would be the terms under which a black regiment might be organized. They did not want to simply sign up and be paid less than white troops and used only for fatigue duty instead of combat and otherwise be treated as second-class soldiers.
The 35th U.S. Colored Troops saw more combat than units like the 135th. Along with the more famous 54th Massachusetts Regiment, the 35th engaged rebels near Jacksonville, Florida, at the Battle of Olestee. Though they were unsuccessful, they were commended by their commanding officers for their bravery. Prokopovich said their stories are only now leaving academia and library archives and are making their way to the general public.
You had black troops fighting at Port Hudson, Louisiana. You had them fighting at Honey Hill in South Carolina. You had them fighting famously at Fort Pillow in Tennessee, where Nathan Bedford Forrest's Confederate soldiers massacred prisoners. They shot down black troops who were surrendering.
No matter how much or how little combat these soldiers experienced, many risked life and limb to enlist. Some of them left plantations, the only place they'd known, to fight against their former masters. Regardless, Deborah Jones and others involved in the project hoped to bring the 135th's accomplishments to light and bring more recognition to black troops who fought for the Union.
I think these people should have some recognition because they participated in their liberty, in their freedom, and they're not getting any recognition.
And to accomplish that mission, the Wayne County Public Library is hosting a presentation on them, 7 p.m., Thursday, February 23rd, at the Wayne County Public Library in Goldsboro on Ash Street. I'm Chris Thomas.
For Black History Month, we explore the civil rights movement in one small eastern North Carolina town. As years have passed since the movement's peak, it's often described in a top-down method. National events, national leaders, perhaps most predominantly 1963's March on Washington, which drew 250,000 people to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. But the fight for civil rights occurred in smaller locations, smaller events as well. A professor at a private Memphis college documented just such a movement. George Olson has this, which originally aired in January 2011.
In February 1960, four students from North Carolina A&T in Greensboro sat down at the local Woolworth's lunch counter, requested service, and were refused. And from there, the sit-in movement spread to other southern cities, just not to Wilson, North Carolina.
What happens in Wilson, as best as I can tell, the students in Wilson in 1960 ask Principal Barnes at Darden, hey, can we have some sit-ins? And Barnes says, no. No, you can't. And again, as far as I can tell, that's sort of the end of it.
Charles W. McKinney, Jr., the author of Greater Freedom, The Evolution of the Civil Rights Struggle in Wilson, North Carolina. The principal he's talking about worked at the city's supposed separate but equal Darden High School. A story, or lack of story, such as what didn't happen during the sit-in movement, would seem to indicate there's not a book in Wilson's civil rights history. But McKinney will tell you he found events that were just off the front page of national news, and if those events never received national recognition, that doesn't mean the events as they occurred in Wilson isn't a story that deserves to be told.
In the late 60s, throughout the 70s, and throughout much of the 80s, the focus on the civil rights story was a very top-down focus, was a focus on national leaders, was a focus on Martin Luther King and national organizations, the NAACP and SNCC, and the federal government, and the role of the president, the role of the governor. So it was a very top-down narrative, and that top-down narrative obscured a lot of the details of local insurgency. So when we tell a top-down story, we lose a lot of nuance.
McKinney's book, Greater Freedom, tries to add that nuance by describing in depth what he describes as a very vibrant movement in Wilson. The book includes what might be termed local flashpoints in the movement, as well as those that preceded the civil rights era, such as this 1942 incident in World War II America.
The Army and Jim Crow decimated any enthusiasm Branford felt about serving his country on Easter Sunday in 1942. On leave before his first deployment, Branford walked into downtown Wilson and entered Woolworth's. At the bar in front of the soda shop sat a row of men with the letters POW emblazoned on the back of their shirts. After getting over his initial shock, Branford, in uniform, walked to the edge of the bar, ordered and received a hot dog. The manager, previously unaware of the potential infringement in racial etiquette, shot across the store, snatched the hot dog out of Branford's hand, and yelled, "You know we don't sell to no niggers." The heat of the incident, now over 60 years past, remains painfully evident in Branford's voice and demeanor. "Here I am, about to go over there and get killed, and these folks sitting up here eating, and they won't let me eat just one meal."
The soldier in the story is Charles Branford, who later taught at the segregated Darden High School. Branford was also involved in the stirrings of the civil rights movement in Wilson, with his involvement in the Men's Civic Club, which in part served as an intermediary between black and white Wilson. Like the national narrative, for a period there was a top-down civil rights movement in Wilson, with recognized organizations leading the way. Eventually, that movement branched out into the community, with local residents frustrated by their lot in life demanding a voice, such as this incident involving Fannie Corbett, at the time a cafeteria cook at an all-white elementary school.
On the eve of the school's annual fundraising events, the principal approached Corbett and her co-workers and told them that they were needed to cook and serve food at the events, at night and without pay. As the principal prepared to leave the cafeteria kitchen, Corbett broke the contentious silence with a firm no. "This is your school," she continued. "You wouldn't expect us to ask you to go to our school and work for nothing." The stunned principal left the kitchen. The room full of black women, who were painfully aware of their tenuous economic positions, debated the wisdom of challenging the principal in such a direct way. Many thought it would be economic suicide to sass the woman responsible for the meager paychecks that they received. Yet Corbett's stance also encouraged others to speak up for themselves. One of their primary motivations, one of the primary reasons that she joins the movement, is because of the reality of economic inequality, because of the reality of the fact that she is consigned to an economic position based largely because of her race that places her on the margins of economic and social viability. And she says no, right? This isn't working for me. And so Corbett is instrumental in helping to mobilize and to energize working class African Americans in Wilson by significantly expanding the scope of what people would call the civil rights issues, if you will. Again, from a top-down narrative, those issues are school desegregation, voting, and into racist violence. But what Corbett does is Corbett comes in and says, okay, this movement is also talking a little bit about economics. It's talking a little bit about employment. It's talking a little bit about these sort of pocketbook issues. Well, we've got to place these issues front and center. And so that's what she does.
Corbett did that by becoming one of the founders of the Wilson Community Improvement Association. And while the youth of Wilson missed the sit-in movement of 1960, they became involved in efforts to desegregate public facilities, including conducting wade-ins to integrate city pools.
One day, during a march and wade-in, an irate local white businessman confronted Gillette. "What are you going to do about it?" he queried. "I don't know. What would you do?" replied Gillette. After pondering the question for a while, the gentleman shrugged, and with a good deal of resignation in his voice, announced, "I'll be damned if I know," and stalked off, with the curses under his breath drowned out by the sounds of black children splashing in a formerly segregated pool.
That scene might best illustrate the white community's reaction to the civil rights movement. Roadblocks were put in the way, but when those blocks were overran, there was begrudging acceptance. And the civil rights movement ultimately evolved to encompass all of the Wilson African American community, from a no to sit-ins to an all-in on desegregating city facilities.
For instance, the role of women in the movement in a place like Wilson, the role of unions, the role of young people, the role of the churches, and the role of everyday citizens who may not have participated in marches and mass mobilizations, but who did at the same time have a sense that they too wanted greater freedom. They too wanted to be more included in the mainstream of American life. And so they picked and chose their battles, if you will, in terms of how to participate, when to participate, and in which way that they would participate in this larger freedom struggle. And so when we have and when we engage in these local studies, when we engage in these community studies that focus really intensely on one place, we're better able to see, again, the variegated nature of the movement there. And I think that when you look at places like Wilson, you become pleasantly surprised at how varied the movement could be in a town of that size.
Charles W. McKinney, Jr. is an assistant professor at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He is the author of Greater Freedom, The Evolution of the Civil Rights Struggle in Wilson, North Carolina. I'm George Olson.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor of the Carolina Chamber Music Festival happening in downtown New Bern starting this Sunday and running through Saturday, February 25th. Today, Mac McKee speaks with director of the Carolina Chamber Music Festival, Jennifer Lucht, about the variety of performances celebrating chamber music.
The Carolina Chamber Music Festival is in its 14th year. How long have you been involved, Jennifer, and how have you seen it grow over the years?
I am one of the founders of the festival. It was founded by two of us, musical friends, myself and Anna Reinersman, who is a harpist, and at the time she was living in New York City. And we happened to be playing some music together and just started talking about music festivals and how we both love to perform in them, and hey, what if we had our own? So that's how it all got started.
Now, this year, the opening event is the Festive Family Concert, which happens this Sunday. Tell me, what can people expect?
Okay, this is a free event, and we're very pleased that the First Presbyterian Church in New Bern is our host for this event this time. We're going to be including piano students and vocal students from Lorraine Hale Music Instruction in New Bern, as well as students who study violin through New Bern's Suzuki Strings with Rachel Harmatuk-Pino. So there's going to be quite a bit of collaborative music that day. So the pianist will be playing with the professional string players. We'll be talking about the cultural context of the pieces that are being played. And it's going to really range a lot from American folk music to traditional classical European composers and Japanese and Chinese music as well.
On Tuesday, February 21st, it's the very popular Classical Lunch Concert at the Bank of the Arts downtown New Bern, featuring in particular works by Johannes Brahms. Can you give us a preview of this performance?
I'm really excited about this one, partly because I get to be an audience member, which is a real joy for me. So Scott Andrews, clarinetist with the St. Louis Symphony, and his wife, pianist Nina Ferrigno of the Calyx Piano Trio, will be presenting a mixed concert. There will be works by major European composers. It's going to range from Stravinsky, Berg, Brahms, some very serious to some really fancy show pieces. So there should be a little bit of something for everybody there that day.
Gao Hong will be featured during the program entitled Musical Diversity, China in America, next Wednesday. Concert goers will hear about her experiences with music in China and hear music for the pipa lute. Now, what is pipa and how would you describe that particular sound?
Yeah, the pipa is not an instrument that we get to hear every day. I first was introduced to it about 10 or 15 years ago, and I was really taken by the sound and the virtuosity and the range of emotional expression that it has. It's an ancient instrument. I think it's at least 2,000 years old, there are many different schools of playing that have evolved over the years, but really people have used it in their daily lives to reflect on nature, to reflect on, events in their life. And so it's been very close to the people and the culture for a long time. The sound specifically, they pluck in a style that maybe even a little bit more akin to a jazz bass. They use harmonics, and there's kind of a ponticello effect, and just really the range of sounds they can get on the instrument. Sometimes it's very serene, and sometimes it's just really exciting and explosive. I'm very excited. Ga Hong is going to be playing one of her works by herself. It's called Flying Dragon, and it was inspired by her life story and her travels and her move from China to America and what she has experienced as a world traveler and musician.
On Thursday, it's the after-work concert East Meets West. Now, this sounds like a part two to the China in America Musical Diversity Program. What musical selections are planned for this evening's performance?
Right. It is pretty much a continuation. Ga Hong and the other professional artists who are joining us this week will be collaborating. So we move on to a little bit more chamber music, including the pipa. We will be premiering the North Carolina premiere, that is, of Ga Hong's own composition, Nostalgia, and that's for piano, cello, clarinet, and pipa, as well as another Chinese-American composer, woman composer, Chen Yi. There's a wonderful kind of arrangement, her own take on a traditional Chinese folk tune called The Fisherman's Song.
The Carolina Chamber Music Festival concludes with the festival finale, where you will be playing cello with the Kalex Piano Trio. Tell me about your group and the festival finale, Jennifer.
Okay. So the finale will feature Kalex Trio, as you said, alongside Ga Hong. We'll be premiering another of her works, Quiet Forest Flowing Stream, which is quite beautiful. The Kalex Trio is going to be playing a work by Bright Sheng, a Chinese-American composer. It's a very difficult and wonderful piece, I will tell you, so I've been practicing it a lot. And we're concluding the program with Mendelssohn's C Minor Trio.
Well, it sounds like it'll be another exciting cultural experience, the Carolina Chamber Music Festival. Jennifer Luck is the director of the Carolina Chamber Music Festival. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And for more information on this Public Radio East media-sponsored event, go to our ENC events page at publicradioeast.org.
This is Byron Mumma, and here's what's up in the Carolina skies this month. When people look up at the night sky, they see hundreds of stars. Most people describe them as points of white light, with some being bright and some being dim. But to have a better appreciation of the stars, I ask you to observe them not just with your eyes, but also with your mind. To illustrate my point, let's focus our attention on two stars this month. These stars are both found in the constellation Orion. Orion can be spotted easily in the winter. If you look about 9 p.m. in February, you'll see Orion due south and look up about 30 degrees high in the sky, and you'll see the large figure of Orion. The two brightest stars in Orion are Betelgeuse and Rigel. Betelgeuse is the top left star, and Rigel is the bottom right star. Each of these stars is described as a supergiant star, but they're actually very different. By looking at these stars with just your eyes, you can see that Betelgeuse has a red tint, and Rigel has a blue-white tint. If you look with binoculars, the color will be more apparent. Thus, Betelgeuse is in the category of a red supergiant star, and Rigel is in the category of a blue supergiant star. Star color tells us what the temperature is. Blue stars are the hottest, while red stars are much cooler. Yellow stars, like our sun, are in between temperature. In the case of these stars, they're both very bright. That means they must either be very large in order to give off great amounts of light, or they must be very close. A star atlas will tell you that Betelgeuse is 427 light-years away, and Rigel is 770 light-years away. By way of comparison, when you're looking at Orion, you could also see the brightest star in our sky, which is Sirius. Sirius is just a little bit bigger than our sun, but appears very bright because it's nearby. It's only about 8 light-years away. So when you're looking at Rigel, you're looking at a star that's 100 times farther away, yet it's very, very bright. So what else might be different about these stars? Their age, their mass. Blue supergiants, like Rigel, have 10 to 100 times more mass than our sun. That means they consume their fuel rapidly and only live for a few million years. Thus, all blue stars are relatively young. Red giants have less mass, they consume their fuel slowly, and reach their size due to their extreme age. In this case, a star like Betelgeuse is near the end of its lifetime, and it may be on the order of 10 billion years. So, you can see that a star like Rigel and a star like Betelgeuse have very different characteristics. This is why, when you're observing, I like to say observe with your mind, not just with your eyes. It makes astronomy interesting when you look at the stars and think about what makes them different from one another. What can you see that gives you a clue about that? If you'd like a good opportunity to see this for yourself, this Saturday we're having our next public star party, sponsored by Carolina Skies Astronomy Club, at the A Time for Science Nature Center. I'll be doing a presentation with more details about this difference between these supergiants. The indoor presentation will be at 6:30, and then if it's clear, we'll go outside and use our telescopes for a much better view of these stars and many other things in the sky. So as you go out, I wish you clear skies in your viewing.